Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're talking with a former Republican state lawmaker who's trying to do something you likely wouldn't imagine anyone who spent 16 years as a Republican legislator in Utah doing. Former St. George Senator Steve Urquhart is, well, there's really no other way to say it than to just say it. He's founding a religion. Okay, maybe that sounds not entirely implausible for someone with his biography. It's the next part that is a bit more out there. The church he's founding has as its sacrament hallucinogenic mushrooms. And so take that as a caveat. This conversation might not be to everyone's liking. It has some descriptions of the use of illegal substances. And it's a conversation that I hope doesn't trivialize the fact that, well, illegal drugs are just that, illegal. Nevertheless, Urquhart says that taking mushrooms entirely changed his life, helped him find a deeper sense of meaning, and provided him with a spiritual experience that he wasn't finding anywhere else. So he's got a church he's trying to create, the Divine Assembly, and as you'll hear, he's using his deep understanding of the law to try to make it a reality, because he wants others to be able to have the same experiences that he has had taking psilocybin mushrooms. I recently met up with Urquhart in downtown Salt Lake City for a socially distanced conversation about the kind of odd thing he's attempting to do that takes him far away from his Mormon conservative roots. Here's our conversation.
Yeah, so Steve Urquhart, political has-been, former state senator, 16 years in Utah legislature. I'm a lawyer. I teach at the medical school. I teach health policy. And I am founder of the Divine Assembly, a church with mushroom sacrament.
So tell us about that Divine Assembly. This is the purpose of this conversation, is I saw Robert Kirky's article or feature profile of what it was you were doing. Divine Assembly, it's a church that you're trying to create. I mean, you have to get approval, I guess, from various taxing authorities. But what's led you to do this, Steve?
I've had some very sacred experiences with psilocybin mushrooms. I was part of organized religion, and that would be the Mormon religion, for most of my life. Joined that when I was 10 and did that actively until I was 45 or so. And the experiences that I've had with psilocybin mushroom, they dwarf any of that. Anything I had in those 35 years of very active participation in an organized religion just pales in comparison to the profound experiences I've had with psychedelics and, in particular, psilocybin mushrooms.
Can you explain, I mean, for the uninitiated out there in the audience, like what that entails? And I know that, like, I think that the popular imagination of what it means to go on a hallucinatory trip or a psychedelic trip is this sort of, you know, it's influenced by our concepts of what the 1960s were.
Right.
And
Hunter S. Thompson.
Counterculture, yeah. So people hear this and they think, well, that's just, you're talking about mystical experience, but it's drugs. So bridge that gap for us if you can.
Sure. So if someone has never done psychedelics before, then a lot of what you read and see in popular culture is fairly accurate. I mean, it can be the circus and carnival and all sorts of beautiful shapes and colors, and it is mystical. It's extraordinary. But to me, that's not nearly enough to call it a religious experience. That is a cool, awesome, different experience. But what I love from it is, to me, all of that I just described, the circus, the carnival, that's just kind of to grab me by the ears and get my attention. Listen up. And then I see my life and my situation very clearly. And the take-homes that I get invariably are about ways that I can better treat my wife and my kids. You know, maybe a few other people in my life, but the first big download I got after just this incredible experience was, you're not showing your love for Sarah. Sarah's my wife. You need to do dishes more. I'm like, really? God appears to me and that's the message, do dishes. And So then the next one was my youngest daughter. Life comes at her very fast. It always has. And again, this crazy, beautiful, mystical experience. And the message was, play games more with Lucy.
Aww.
Yeah, you know, so God said, Uno, man, do it.
So I guess, I mean, there's a lot that's been written about. I mean, I'm halfway through the Michael Pollan book, How to Change Your Mind.
And it's fantastic.
There's a lot that's been written about the breaking down of the ego and the sort of self-access to an experience that, you know, people might spend a lifetime trying to find in other places.
Yeah.
I guess, why a church?
Yeah, and I'm going to answer another question that you sort of asked,
yeah.
Didn't ask first.
Yeah.
I just want to be clear. It I'm not saying it's just psychedelics that can get us to this mystical state of consciousness. It could be yoga, meditation. It could be prayer. It could be scripture, song, a lot of things. But okay, back to the question you did answer. Why a church? A, because I do think that these experiences are religious. I mean, I have no other word for some of these things than rapture. I mean, it's all the superlative words. And this is what William James, one of our great American scholars on religion, said, is that we encounter God in mystical states of consciousness. And I think I've done that a number of times. And now when I say God, I see God in my wife, in my kids. And part of it is, I think I go through life somewhat blind. I think maybe a lot of us do. I don't see a lot of things that are right in front of my face. And so in these spaces, I've seen my wife and my kids just how they really are, which is just extraordinarily beautiful and wonderful. And it moves me, and it moves and inspires me to be better to them and to be a better human. And so all of that I'm describing, that's religion, right? You see something amazing, something that defies our description, and it inspires us to be better. But then there also is the pragmatic concern that there's a lot of protection in religion. In the legislature, I fought for LGBTQ rights, and most of that fight was fighting against organized religion. And religion was arguing that their sincere religious beliefs allowed them to treat LGBTQ folks poorly. That legally they didn't have to treat LGBTQ people as equals because their God didn't want them to. So, you know, quite candidly, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and these First Amendment rights, they're being broadly used to justify some really crummy behavior. And I happen to become pretty expert on those rights. And
right.
I put two and two together and figured, wait, I'm having profoundly religious experiences, but me and my friends, when we do them, we're having to hide in basements. We can't really talk publicly about them.
Yeah.
It needs to be really underground, yet organized religion is using these protections to do some really crummy things publicly. So why don't we use these protections? And why don't we call this what it is? I mean, a lot of people who do psychedelics, what I'm hearing is, oh man, don't call it a church, don't call it a religion. We've been abused by religion. Well, okay, but God really can be something amazing. God doesn't have to be a bigot. God doesn't have to be small. God can be huge. God can be as big as I'm seeing, as they're seeing in these psychedelic experiences. We can call it what it is, which is religion. You have to say that word. First Amendment, Religious Freedom Restoration Act. They don't protect philosophies, beliefs. They protect religion. And so to me, this is religion. Let's call it religion. And let's bring it up out of the basements if people so choose. And in that, there can be safety. There can be community.
So practicalities. I mean, is part of this that you want people to access the same experiences that you have accessed, and those who want to join your church, are they going to be able to access that kind of experience? Meaning, especially given the fact that we're talking about basically illicit substances,
yeah,
Can you talk about that from a legal perspective, like what it means to have a church that is founded around the idea of psilocybin?
Yeah.
And then how you imagine others getting access to the same experience as you have.
Yeah, so I spent 2 years proselytizing for the Mormon Church because I thought it was great and I wanted others to experience that. And so here, I think these things are great. They can be life-changing, we can heal, and I want others to access that. And so psychedelic substances and worship with psychedelic sacraments, it is legal. And there are a couple of big cases on that. One was an 8-0, so unanimous Supreme Court decision, Alito wasn't on the court at that point, saying that an ayahuasca church in New Mexico, it could use ayahuasca, which has DMT, a Schedule I controlled substance. A United States District Court in Oregon reached the same conclusion with another ayahuasca church. That was the Santo Daime case. Both of those were sects, offshoots of Brazilian sects. And so the logic of those cases would 100% apply to psilocybin sacrament. What courts will look at is, well, at least what they should look at, right? Those are two cases. Those two cases apply to those two situations.
Okay.
So you never know how they'll...
But they could represent a sort of precedent, is what you're hoping.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Because you look at the premises of those cases. It is, this is sincere religious belief. We will protect it under the First Amendment Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Right.
What the court... What both of those courts looked for is they looked for sincerity of belief, and they looked to see, are people safe? So psilocybin mushrooms, we know that they are physically safe. They're not addictive. You're not going to die from them.
There's no cases of overdoses as far as we know.
Right, right. And so physically it is safe. You know, you can have psychological trauma. I'm quick to say that. And you can do dumb things when you're on them if you don't have good set and setting. But the logic of those cases, it should protect our worship so long as we're sincere. And so that is what I always am sure to say and remind people is this isn't an attempt to get around drug laws. What this is this is an attempt to worship above ground, to worship publicly.
Yeah. I guess a follow-up question that I have on that, and I'm totally deviating from the structure of the interview that I wanted, but who defines what constitutes religion?
The spiritual giants at the IRS and the DEA. Seriously, that's what it comes down to. They're the ones who say, yeah, this seems as odd as that is, that's who does it. And so they look for certain things. Does this seem like a church? And but at the end of the day, I'm sure in my case, it will be a court. I mean,
yeah.
You know, no doubt if we have some success with this, we're going to find ourselves in court. Some overzealous prosecutor will think this is not religion, and we'll probably get the opportunity to explain this to a judge.
You talked about those two cases that were sort of the precedents that you were maybe going to be able to point to. I'm wondering if those were religions, though, that were started anew. I mean, meaning
right.
They may have been churches recognized newly by the United States, but were they churches started anew from whole cloth?
Yeah, that's a perfect question. Both courts did find it highly relevant that these were official religions in Brazil. We think we have religious freedom. We don't compared to Brazil. Brazil is really, really open to religions. And so both the Santo Daime Church and the União do Vegetal, Union of the Plants, those were both official Brazilian religions. Plus you add the exotic nature of that these, the courts to some degree, they're like, well, you know, if it's okay in Brazil, we don't want to be less hospitable to religious freedom, and it's Brazil, we don't quite understand it, it's exotic, and where, you know, okay, yeah, we sort of get Steve, we get this. And so, yeah, I think you're right. There might be a higher bar to clear.
Well, it'll be something for you to try and clear. I wonder if you, well, we'll come back around to that, how long it might take. But I'm wondering, you know, is this going to put you or the church that you found, you know, assuming that everything gets approved, in the position of being a kind of dealer of an illicit substance? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, how would you imagine getting access to
psilocybin. That's the $64 question. Yeah. Or maybe a, you know, 6-year to 20-year sentence pending good behavior question. No, and so the way that this church is designed is it's very decentralized. It's like the mycelial network, the roots of mushrooms, where here is the religion. You worship the one tenet is we believe that we can commune with the divine through psilocybin sacrament. And then safety, we really insist on safety. But beyond that, it's not top-down hierarchical dogma. So you can start your congregation and do your stuff as long as you follow that tenet and the safety principles, and we can learn from each other. So this is kind of really a 2020 religion that is so disintermediated. And so as part of that, I don't have a church edifice that can be raided, and I don't, you know, grow and supply the sacrament. I mean, that is probably the main question I get is, cool, bro, can you hook me up? And so I'm like, no, I can't. I'm not a drug dealer. I don't want to be your drug dealer. But that is one of the beautiful things about psilocybin is you can get the spores legally, and they're really pretty easy to grow. And so part of what we will have, because it's not acceptable when people say, cool, I want to join your church. Where do I get the sacrament? And I say, well, you're completely on your own. They're like, oh, wow, this is kind of a dud. But if I say, look, here are the reasons we don't supply, here are some videos from expert mycologists showing you exactly how you can grow these things, then, you know, kind of New Testament stuff about teach a man to fish. I mean, you know, teach a seeker to grow mushrooms.
I think some of our listeners might think, some might be really intrigued, others might be kind of terrified, worry about questions of, you know, especially in Utah, the sort of safety for the kids, you know, like, are kids going to have access to this stuff? And Steve, should they have access to this stuff?
No, they shouldn't. I mean, this is what we say is we only want folks who are over 21, and I'm sure not going to make any kind of push for people who are young at all. I mean, folks like you, your brains are still flexible, and, you know, you get old and crusty like me, you got to knock loose some of the barnacles. And I really do think that psychedelics really are for folks who have maybe some more miles on the tire and some trauma. And I just think they work better when you have some age on you. And so, no, we will be really active at discouraging use by minors and even, you know, anyone under 21. And I would say under 25, under 30, why are you doing these things, you know?
Can you actually just, I'm going to sidetrack you for a second and talk about recreational use versus the use that you think this should be used for? And then maybe you can also describe that concept of set and setting.
Yeah.
And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, so set and setting is all important. And what that means is you go into a session with what intention, what's your frame of mind? That's your set. And then the setting is where are you doing it? These things, every time I speak, I just want people to know they carry some danger in that you are in an extremely vulnerable state, and that's where the magic happens. But because you're in a vulnerable state, you sure don't want to be dealing with traffic or anything like that. You really shouldn't even be out and about much. And you want to make sure you're with people who will keep you safe. I mean, you can have psychedelic predation, whether it is emotional, whether it's spiritual, sexual. And that's part of the reason why I want this to be a legal religion, is people are doing these things. Let's do them in a great set and setting, build each other, have strong, healthy community, rather than have people in vulnerable situations.
Michael Pollan kind of talks about set being mindset, what you're taking as you go into it, meaning what you're bringing to the experience,
right,
where you are sort of in a mental state, and then setting being, I mean, kind of the physical setting, literally who you're with, who's going to guide you. Is that part of what the church will do, is be a sort of counselor, guider?
Absolutely. Establish best practices And so what I say in a few places is, if this is your first time, or you know, maybe your second time, pick your guide with the same level of care you would pick your brain surgeon. Not just some dude, hey, I understand you do these, can you hook me up? And you're making a mistake with that. And so by bringing it above board, let's bring in people who have great experience, great intention, and let's even bring in people who have some degrees. I mean, integration is hugely important here. After your experience, you shouldn't be done, because it might have been super interesting and colorful. You have some weird stories. But what does it mean for your life? And there are folks who are really well trained at dealing with that. You know, you come and sit on their couch, sit in their chair, and they can help you work through, okay, here's what happened. Let's talk about it. And then we reach some great conclusions. Oh my gosh, this is what it means. I mean, so for me, I'm doing a lot of work on young Steve, you know, where I just developed some bad programming and where I just was really kind of lost and alone. So going back to those places and just kind of working forward in a more whole and loving condition. I realized at one point that through a psychedelic experience that I've never loved fiercely in my life. I've only loved partially. And I mean, that was a devastating realization, a very accurate one. And so realizing it, I now have the opportunity to love fiercely, and it's fantastic.
I had a thought about there's this sort of almost Protestant Reformation concept, right? Like the who has access to the divine, who gets to connect to that. And I think that a lot of people with the framework they're bringing to this conversation are going to hear what you're describing and think again that it's not access to the divine, that it's kind of false, that what they have is the real deal, and that what you're describing is access to something fake, hallucinations, for example, which are, you know, a product of chemical reactions. I mean, why do you think that it's a real spiritual journey?
Yeah, I mean, I would flip that narrative 180 degrees. You take the faith that I grew up with, Mormonism. Joseph Smith had some experiences. Sidney Rigdon had some experiences. You know, you take a lot of the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther had some experiences. And then that's kind of how religion works, is the founders and early acolytes, they have these mystical direct communions. And then everyone else is a bit, you could say, living off borrowed light, right? You have to have faith that that person had that experience. And then your experiences, your revelations, they can only ratify those experiences, right? Or it's blasphemy. Where you're confined in terms of how you can commune with the God and who God is. And so what I'm saying is, I've had some experiences, that noetic experiences, that they're absolutely definitive to me. I say more real than reality, some of these things. But no one else has to believe them. What the Divine Assembly says is, you can go find out for yourself. And since you and I are different people, you're probably going to have just a different realization, a different experience. But no one is conscripted. No one is forced to believe my revelations, your revelations. Everyone can go seek for themselves. They can have an actual one-on-one experience with the divine.
Is it safe? Are psychedelics safe?
Well, okay, perfect question. So part of the reason I'm doing this is because, yes, they are very safe physically. You're not going to be addicted. You're not going to die from ingesting psilocybin mushrooms. But again, part of the reason I'm doing this is because the experiences often are not safe. And the reason they're not safe is set and setting, that there might be bad people who are guiding people into harm's way, or people can have psychedelic trauma. A great trip for me is, at some point, there's this gooey puddle of Steve in the middle of the floor, where I've just realized something, that I'm too patriarchal, that, you know, I don't love fiercely. And it's just devastating to see that. But then for me, I'm fortunate that the psilocybin sacrament, it always lifts me up. in that very ceremony, I'm like, okay, wow, here are the ways I can do better. But let's say they don't lift a person, that a person is left in that gooey puddle, that they realize they relive trauma, or you know, they're in the middle of working through something, they're gonna need some help resolving that. And that is something that they really should be in touch with someone who has tremendous training, whether it's professional training or years and years and years in the cycle, in the psychedelic space. It's like, I would never pretend to truly guide someone. I don't have enough experience. I don't have the training. I don't have the gift. And so that's kind of what I'm putting out there, is be careful who you have, because I started this and I wouldn't want to guide people.
What about that? What, I mean, there's been a lot of research done on the, you know, new research since the 1990s, as Michael Pollan's book points out, on the therapeutic beneficial impacts of using psychedelics, especially for people who maybe are severely depressed. There's experiments with terminal cancer patients who have who come to terms with their own death. I guess, again, I'm going to go back to why a church and why not a therapist, you know?
There are amazing things going on with the medicalization of psychedelics. John Hopkins is doing tremendous work with the benefit of psilocybin mushrooms and depression. I mean, just really some miraculous work there. MAPS is doing great works with MDMA, Molly, as people know it from the club scene, and PTSD. I mean, on and on and on. For addiction, they're great things. So the medicalization of these substances is happening wonderfully. But what about people who, you know, are mostly well, but just want to be better? As Bob Jess, someone big in this space, says, you have the medicalization front, but then what about the betterment of well people? That's kind of what religion is, a form of healing, right? We have medicine that can heal our broken bones and, you know, whatever illnesses we have, but what about our soul? And that's where religion comes in and can heal our soul. And I think that's a very important thing. If we just stop at medicalization of these substances, we've missed it, because they can heal our souls also.
It sounds like what you're talking about is a sort of spiritual preventative medicine, or preventative healthcare.
Yeah,
I mean, spiritual, to separate, those two ideas don't go together very well, but you know what I mean.
Well, if we can forget a lot of what we have been wrongly taught about God and religion, I think what I'm talking about is religion, that you know, there is something beyond us that is magical, mystical, and wonderful. And to the extent we can tie into that, we are better and we treat others around us better.
Steve Urquhart, thanks very much for making time to talk to me about this.
Hey, what a great conversation. Thank you.
Again, that's Steve Urquhart, a former Republican state lawmaker who has filed paperwork in Utah to create the Divine Assembly, a church centered around psilocybin mushrooms. Just a note that the book we referenced a few times in the interview is How to Change Your Mind by the best-selling nonfiction writer Michael Pollan, who's probably best known for his book The Botany of Desire. How to Change Your Mind is about Pollan's decision to take and then write about these drugs, and it's also about the history of the research that was being done into the therapeutic effects of psychedelics, how that research came to a screeching halt, and how it's lately picked up again. It's also a book, to some extent, about the mystery of the nature of consciousness. What the book is not is a treatise on or an argument for the recreational use of these drugs, which isn't something that Steve Urquhart argued for in our interview either. And that's all the time we have for on the show today. You've been listening to In the Hive from KCPW, a listener-supported, independent, local public radio resource. Podcasts are available out there in the ether. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in. Join us again next week.